All right, hope you have your Bible with you. I'd ask you to take it out and turn to the book of Romans. Romans chapter 1 will be our first, right on top of you guys here, sorry. So I thought he warned you about the splash zone. You guys are right in the middle of it here, so I'll try to move around so you don't get direct hit too many times. Romans chapter 1 will be the first place that we're going to read from in just a moment tonight. This is a lot of fun. This is really a joy for Beth and I to be here. We get to come here every once in a while, obviously visiting the kids, not so much Lacey and Travis, but we like to come see the kids and we put up with them as well. But it's a special treat to be here for something like this. I guess maybe I'll start wide here. I mean, to the whole congregation, and especially the elders, and to Paul and to BJ, and I appreciate the kind words, BJ. Thanks to you for having in mind something like this, having a desire as a congregation to focus some concentrated teaching and some time for the young people to spend time together and to receive that teaching. It's a really valuable thing. When I look back at the time that I was y'all's age, which, as you can see, was not that long ago, these were some of the most cherished memories I can look back on and think about the weekends that I spent with other young people, having fun, of course, but also studying the Word of God and thinking about the Word of God. And so to you all, thank you for being here and making this important. I remember when I was in high school hearing a preacher say to a gathering of young people that the world sets a pretty low bar for young people. The world thinks that young people really are only interested in like having fun and goofing off. But I know things like this prove that expectation wrong, because you guys have shown up here, and I'm sure you'll probably have some fun if y'all are hanging out later tonight, but you guys have come here to sit and listen to me talk about the Bible. And that's because you have a desire for greater things. And I appreciate that in you, and I would encourage in you to cultivate that, and again, as a congregation, to cultivate that in these young people as much as you can. We're talking this week, you may have seen or heard that we're talking about this idea of idols. Keep yourselves from idols. That's actually a phrase that comes from the Bible. We'll maybe look at that, where it comes from, tomorrow. But it's a phrase that's found at the end of the book of 1 John. It's actually the last line in the book of 1 John. The apostle says, "Little children, keep yourselves from idols." I noticed they didn't put the little children part in the title of the, or did you? I didn't see. But that might have been a little bit condescending to say, "Little children, keep yourselves from idols." But the apostle John, talking to the Christians that he's writing to, says, keep yourselves from idols. I want you to put yourself, or try to put yourself, in the situation of those first century Christians that are living in a Roman world. You guys have probably done enough world history to imagine a society where people worshipped idols, where they had little images. And this has really been happening since I would say from the very beginning of human history, but it didn't take too long in human history for people to come up with these gods that they worshipped. And they would be of wood or stone, and they would call them all kinds of different names, and there would be a lot of them, and they would have temples and shrines, and they would bow down to them and worship them. And this is what we call idolatry. And really from this really second book of the Bible, even before that, in the book of Genesis, there are warnings against God's people going after idolatry all the way through the end of the New Testament. There's warnings about God's people falling into idolatry. What is an idol? What do you imagine when you think of that idea? I'm glad I have this slide up here. I have to stop right in the middle, a dead stop, and explain this here. This is something we're trying this weekend, and I hope it will be useful for you. Tomorrow afternoon, after lunch, I think, we're going to spend some time discussing and fielding some of your questions that you have about what we're talking about. And so we want to encourage you to take what you're thinking and how you're processing this information, questions you might have. And maybe I think the questions might specifically be kind of practical things. So if we touch on some topics this week, I want to hear more about this topic. So how would you deal with this kind of situation? What would you say about this scenario? We want you to ask those kinds of questions and for us to have a chance to discuss those things tomorrow afternoon. So here's what we're going to do. There's actually a site you can go to. This is a URL that's up here. And this will be on every slide tonight. And you can go here and just submit a question. Now, it's going to ask for your name. You can skip that, and so it'll be an anonymous submission. But take your phone out. It won't bother me too much, and I'm going to say some things this weekend about phones, so I just so you know, I'm not like all phones all the time in favor of that. But tonight, I will trust that if you have your phone out, perhaps you're going to this URL here and insert a question. This will be active all the way through tomorrow afternoon. And so then tomorrow afternoon, we'll have a record of the questions that have been submitted, and then we can answer them, try to answer them, or at least discuss them tomorrow afternoon. So go here and submit a question if you have one, either during the session tonight, later on tonight, or sometime tomorrow morning. What is an idol? What comes to your mind when you think of idol? Well, basically, here's what I would say an idol is. There are three things that go into it. One is that an idol is a cheap imitation of God. So if you imagine that little wood stone thingy that people bow down to, this is supposed to be God, but it's really, we recognize, a lesser version of God. In fact, these idols are claimed to be able to do some things, but they're not able to do everything. So that's why there's a God for the rain and a God for the sun. Like, each God can do a little bit and have a little bit of power, but they're not all-powerful. They're cheap imitations. They're lesser versions of God. They're kind of like God as we know Him, but they're not. They're cheap imitations of Him. Really, beyond that, though, these idols are based on man's desires. When people in these societies made up idols, they were making up idols and worshiping them based on what they wanted. Okay, so remember some of what we just mentioned, right? So there's a God for the rain. Now, why do people make up a God for rain? Well, because they would like for there to be rain. And why would they like for there to be rain? So that their crops can grow, right? So it's a very kind of a basic human desire that we want it to rain. And so we create a God that is the rain God. Same thing could be said for the God of the sun, maybe a God for war and victory, or a God for love and romance, or a God for happiness and peace. These are things that humans want. They desire these things, and so they just make a God and say, well, this God is going to give me that thing. And really, the other side of it is that they then give their devotion, their ultimate devotion to that God. So you have to worship the God. That's what you do with gods. And worship is giving of a sacrifice or going through some kind of ritual, right? You're devoting yourself, your time, your money, your stuff. You're giving it away. And maybe you remember in the Bible some pretty extreme examples of this. You remember a god named Molech, where the worship involves sacrificing your children to worship that god, right? This was something that the idols required people to worship, to put them up as the ultimate object of devotion. And this does seem, it seems really weird, like really strange. Like, how in the world could people ever come up with this? That seems stupid and so foreign that people would have these little gods and worship them because they expected to get something in return. This just doesn't seem to make much sense. Let me read you something. This comes from a book I actually would recommend. So if you want to write it down, look it up, and go read it later, I would recommend it. It's called Counterfeit Gods, and it's by an author named Timothy Keller. And this is what he says, one of the things he says in his introduction. He says, our culture is not fundamentally different from the ancient ones. So we think they're crazy for having all these gods and worshiping them. He says, our culture is not fundamentally different from the ancient ones. Each culture is dominated by its own set of idols. Each has its priesthoods, its totems, its rituals. Each one has its shrines, whether office towers, spas, or gyms, studios, or stadiums, where sacrifices must be made in order to procure the blessing of the good life and ward off disaster. What are the gods of beauty, power, money, and achievement, but these same things that have assumed mythic proportions in our individual lives and in our society? See what he's saying? He's saying that we still have idols. They're anything that we lift up as being of ultimate importance, and we go to those things to try to gain some sort of fulfillment or some sort of blessing from that thing. And he lists a few there in that list of money, power, beauty, achievement. Here's what he says. He says, we may not physically kneel before the statue of Epaphrodite, but many young women today are driven into depression and eating disorders by an obsessive concern over their body image. We may not actually burn incense to Artemis, but when money and career are raised to cosmic proportions, We perform a kind of child sacrifice. Maybe this is more for parents than for kids right now. We perform a kind of child sacrifice, neglecting family and community to achieve a higher place in business and gain more prestige. Here's what he says a little bit later on. The human heart takes good things, like a successful career, love, material possessions, even family, and turns them into ultimate things. Our hearts deify them as the center of our lives because we think they can give us significance and security and safety and fulfillment if we attain them. Those are things that we want. Security, significance, safety, fulfillment. We're talking about some of those things tonight. We want those things. That's how we're made. But what the author is saying here is that we search for those things in all the wrong places. And what he says here is interesting. He says we take good things and we exalt them to ultimate things, thinking that they will give us that security and fulfillment that we are longing for. So what we would say then is that an idol is anything that we make more important than God. An idol is anything that we make more important than God. Now here's where this gets tricky. I want to try to, if I can keep myself from it, if I can, you know, restrain myself tonight. I don't want to keep saying this over and over again. Hopefully I can just say it once and then you'll remember that I said it at the beginning, so I don't have to keep repeating it. One of the things that's tricky about this whole conversation is that we're going to talk about a lot of things that are not sinful. We're going to talk about things and give warnings about things that they are not sins. In fact, they may even be good, and they can provide some sort of blessing, some even sort of spiritual benefit to you. Even remember in this list that the author said, even things like a career and family and possessions. These are not what we would call sinful things. They are not bad things. Your family is not bad. I guess I can't speak for everybody here. I'm assuming your family is not bad, okay? But the point is that idol is when we take something that might even be a good thing and we exalt it to be more important than God. We exalt it to make it an ultimate thing. And we think and we live as if that thing is going to provide us with the security, the fulfillment, and the satisfaction that we are longing for. Okay, this is what brings us to Romans chapter 1. So have your Bible, maybe some of you are using your phone. That'll do, I guess, for now. You can use your phone if you're looking at this. Romans chapter 1. We'll read a little bit here, and I want you to notice, again, Paul, like the Apostle John, who said, little children, keep yourselves from idols, Paul is writing, living in a world where they did bow down to idols. And he's going to talk some about that in this passage, but notice that Paul is really talking about more than just, again, the act of bowing down to a statue. That there's more going on here with idolatry than just that. Notice in Romans chapter 1, verse 18, and we'll read here to the end of the chapter. Notice how Paul talks about this idea of making things more important than God and worshiping them as idols, what that does and is about the human heart. Romans 1:18, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature, have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. You see, so God was trying to show himself to them in creation. They should have seen creation and learned about God. But notice verse 21. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and of four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Therefore, God gave them over in the lusts of their hearts to impurity so that their bodies would be dishonored among them. For they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator who is blessed forever. Amen. Verse 26, for this reason God gave them over to degrading passions, for their women exchanged the natural function for that which is unnatural. And in the same way also the men abandoned the natural function of the woman and burned in their desire toward one another, men with men committing indecent acts and receiving in their own persons the due penalty of their error. Verse 28, and just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer, God gave them over to a depraved mind, to do those things which are not proper, being filled with all unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, evil, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents. Let's make sure you heard that. Without understanding, untrustworthy, unloving, unmerciful, and although they know the ordinance of God and those who practice such things are worthy of death, they not only do the same, but also give hearty approval to those who practice them. Have you ever made a bad trade, right? Those of you guys that are in public school, people are probably still trading food at the lunch table, right? That's still a thing, right? I'm sure for your older, it's always been a thing. You trade food at the lunch table. You ever made a really bad trade? Like you saw your friend's lunch and you thought, man, that sandwich looks really good. And you say, I'm going to trade this, you know, regular, safe old PB&J for that sandwich, that bologna sandwich looks so good. And you trade and then you realize that what you gave up was far better than what you got back. And it was a bad trade. Romans 1 here is about a bad trade. That the people here that Paul talks about, they made a bad exchange. And what Paul says here actually is the same thing that we, as we've seen already, continue to do as humans. Here's what these people did in this story. They had the glory of God right in front of them. Mary talked about the creation. They knew God. The glory of the incorruptible God was right there at their fingertips, accessible to them. Can you imagine God's glory, His incorruptible glory? It never fades away. It's perfect. It's beautiful. It's good. They had the glory of God. They traded it away. So they exchanged the glory of God for the image of a corruptible man. And that calls to mind those statues and of those gods that they would bow down to. Have you ever seen those? You know, they don't even look much like a real man. It's just a poor little image. And the image is of a man, and men are already corrupted. But this is not even a man, it's an image of a corruptible man. But they chose that. They said, no, we don't want God, the glorious, incorruptible God. We want this image of a corruptible man. Now, by the way, why did they do that? Why did people say they wanted to worship those little images? Well, we already said it. It's because of what they wanted. Their own desires drove them. So let's create a God that will allow me to, or maybe even tell me to do the things that I want to do, right? And then I'll worship that God. That sounds like the kind of God I want to worship. That's the gods that they created. So they rejected the glory of the incorruptible God, and instead they took for themselves the corruptible image of man. Well, it goes on even farther than that to say in verse 25 that they exchanged the truth of God. So they had the truth of God, and they exchanged it for a lie. They had the truth of God, and they exchanged it for a lie. Here's what I think is happening. So they started by losing sight of who God is, right? So that's the first thing that this text says, that they forgot and they lost sight of who God is. And once they did that, they started losing sight of everything else. So once you lose sight of who God is, the whole world doesn't make sense anymore. Because God made the world and He ordered it and He sustains it and He directs it. So you throw God out, and all of existence, all of reality, basically goes out the window with God. And so now they didn't have reality. They didn't have truth anymore. What they had was all, it was a deception. It was a lie. So they lost sight of who God was in favor of their idols. With that, they lost sight of reality and were living in a lie. But this gets even worse. Eventually, it says that they exchanged natural functions for functions that were unnatural. And we understand that this passage is about, as he talks about these natural and unnatural functions, he's talking about homosexuality. And maybe you've heard this passage read and talking about the sin of homosexuality, right? That men and women, right, were made for each other, which is the natural way of things, okay, according to God's reality. But they threw that out, and they started doing things that were unnatural, men with men, women with women. But I hope you notice that homosexuality is not the only thing that's being talked about in Romans 1, because he goes on to list a whole bunch of other things as well. Remember, there's the disobedience to parents. I don't know if I mentioned that before. That's in the list. And there's a lot of other things too. And what is that list? It's a list of all the things that men and women started doing, once they threw out God, once they threw out God's truth. They gave away their natural functions for something unnatural. What that means is that they threw out who they were supposed to be for something that they were never meant to be. So not only did they lose sight of who God is, not only did they lose sight of God's reality, they lost sight of who they were themselves. Lost sight of what it really meant to be human and replaced it with something that was really not human. You guys probably understand this, that if you use something for a purpose for which it was not made, it usually, one, doesn't do the job very well, and two, it breaks the thing, right? So let's say you need a screwdriver, and you don't have a screwdriver, and so the closest thing you have is a pencil, okay? Now, was a pencil made to turn screws? This is a software, no, it's not made for that. Okay? But if you try to use a pencil for turning screws, which it wasn't made to do, okay? One, you may turn the screw a couple times, but it's not going to take you very long. That pencil is going to break. And so now you can't turn the screw and your pencil is broken. This is, I think, similar to what Paul was describing in the book of Romans. Humans, like you and me, men and women, all of us, we left the things that we were made, we left the function that we were made for. God made us to honor Him, to serve Him. And we left that aside and started doing our own thing. We started doing things that we were not made for. Again, see that list of all the things here: strife, deceit, malice, gossip, slanderers, haters of God, boastful. We start doing all these things that we were never meant for, living in ways that we were never meant for, and guess what happens? Not only do we not serve God the way He expects, but we actually are destructive to ourselves. And that's the kind of the scary truth of Romans chapter 1. And it really all comes down to this statement that he makes in the middle of that text, which is that what these people did is they served the creature rather than the Creator. They worshiped and served the creature rather than the Creator. God had made them. And God had made them for a certain purpose. God had made them to have a relationship with Himself. God had made them to serve Him, to glorify Him. But they, and again, we, stopped serving the God that made us and started serving the things that He made. And that's what we want to talk about this weekend, is how we have come as people to serve the things that God made, to worship the things that God made. Tonight we're going to talk about people, okay? People are made by God. But what we do, as we'll talk about for the next few minutes, is that we look to people to give us the fulfillment and the meaning that we can only get from God who made us. But instead of looking to God for fulfillment and meaning, we look to try to get that from our relationships with other people. Tomorrow we're going to talk about things. So how we look to the things that we have, possessions, money, achievements. We look to those things that God has made and given us and try to find fulfillment in those things as opposed to finding fulfillment in God Himself. So for the next few minutes, let's talk about this. That God made us and that He promised us something more fulfilling, satisfying than we can ever imagine. One of the first verses in the Bible here, the Genesis chapter 1, as it talks about God making the world and God making mankind, it says that He created man in His image. That means God and man have a connection, that we are made to be like Him. We are made to have a relationship with Him. That's why God made us. He is a relational being in the sense that He can have relationship. And He made us to be the same way. We're the only ones made like that. I know you love your dog, and I love my dog. Trust me. I never thought I could love a dog so much. It took like 12 minutes, and I loved my dog more than I ever thought I could. But we don't have the same kind of connection, relationship with other creation as we do amongst ourselves, because we are made in God's image. We are made to have relationship. And we were made by God, who also has relationship. And we were made to have a relationship with Him. And that was very good. That relationship with God is very good. I think that's an understatement. That it was perfect. That's the way it's supposed to be, to have a relationship with God. He made us for that. But the problem is that we start to seek the things that only God can provide us with. We try to seek those things in other people. So let me give you three things tonight. Three needs that we have. Three relational needs that we have that God has made us for. Right? So these are things that He gave to us, these needs. Three needs that we have in terms of relationship that we're supposed to have, and God has told us that He will give to us in Him. Right? So three needs that God will provide if we will seek Him, but we try to fulfill these needs in our relationships with other people. First thing I think is a pretty basic one, and it's the desire for attention. That's kind of like the lowest level, that we as humans have been made with a desire to be noticed. I want people to pay attention to me. When people don't pay attention to me, I don't like that, okay? I don't think that's selfish. I think that's just the way we're made. We're made to long for and to need attention to be given to us, right? Now, here's the thing. Don't forget that blue box right above that, okay? God made you. He's the creator of the universe. He made Mount Everest. He made the Milky Way galaxy. He made all the planets. He made the sun, the stars, right? The depths of the ocean. And He made you, personally. He made you and formed you. Talk about attention. The creator of the universe knows you, made you, in His image. What more attention do we need than that? A couple of passages I want you to look with me at and notice how powerful this is. Look at what Peter says in 1 Peter chapter 5 here. Writing to Christians. So again, we're talking about a blessing we have in Christ. And notice what Peter says in 1 Peter 5, verse 6 and 7. He says, "Therefore, humble yourselves under the mighty hand of God, that He may exalt you at the proper time, casting all your anxiety on Him, because He cares for you." Read that last part again. Cast all your anxiety on Him, because He cares for you. I think we probably desire attention the most when we are going through difficult things, right? When we are hurting, we want other people to attend. That's the word we use, right? When you're sick, you would like your parents to attend to you and make sure that you get better, pay attention to you, to take care of you so that you get well. And that's the way that we function. When we're in need, when we have a difficulty, we want people to pay attention to that. We want it to matter to somebody else that we're hurting and someone to pay attention to us. God, who created everything, the God of the universe, He cares for you. Whatever anxiety that we have, whatever trouble it is that we're going through, Peter says He cares for you and cares about what you're going through. I don't know if y'all sing the song here. It's one of my more favorite songs. Does Jesus care? And the verses all each ask the question, does Jesus care? And there's a lot of things that are asked. When I'm going through temptation, when I'm hurting, when I'm discouraged, when I've lost a loved one, does Jesus care? Does Jesus care? And the chorus every time says, oh yes, He cares. I know He cares. His heart is touched with my grief. The King of Kings and Lord of Lords cares about you and cares about your problem. He's paying attention. He's promised us that. He's told us that. Look over with me too at a chapter, and we'll look at a few verses here. So I just wanted you to turn to the chapter in Matthew chapter 6. Jesus speaking here. Matthew chapter 6. A couple different things here we'll look at. One is in the second part of the chapter, verse 25 and following. He's talking about, again, similar to 1 Peter 5, about anxiety and worry. Verse 25 of Matthew chapter 6. For this reason I say to you, do not be worried about your life, what you will eat, what you will drink, or for your body as to what you will put on. Because life is more than food and the body is more than clothing. So Jesus is saying the same thing. You have these anxieties. Don't worry. Do not be anxious. Why? How can you say that? How can you say don't be anxious? Verse 26. Look at the birds of the air, that they do not sow nor reap nor gather into barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are you not worth much more than they? Who's more important to God, you or a bird? Pretty easy question, right? We already talked about it. You're made in the image of God. Birds are important. I think God cares about birds, right? If you have a bird, I'm sure that bird is very special and special to God. But you're more important than a bird. You're made in the image of God. And if God pays attention to every single little bird that's in the world, He's paying attention to you. He cares about you. And whatever anxiety you have, whatever worry you have, whatever difficulty you have, God knows about it. He cares about it. He's paying attention to it. So here's what's interesting is that I think in the same chapter we have a kind of the other side of this, right? Because later in the chapters we just saw Jesus says, God's paying attention to you, okay? So don't worry. But look at where this chapter begins in Matthew chapter 6, verse 1. The first half of this chapter is a warning about attention. And later on, he's going to say, God's paying attention to you. Don't worry. But notice what he says at the beginning of the chapter, Matthew chapter 6, verse 1. He says, beware of practicing your righteousness before men, to be noticed by them. Otherwise, you have no reward with your Father who is in heaven. And he goes on to say the same basic thing about three practices, about giving to the poor, about prayer, and about fasting. And with each of those things, he says, don't do those things to be noticed, to receive attention from men. Do it to be noticed by God. And you see how this fits together, right? Because if you know God is paying attention to you, then that should be the only thing that matters. But when we lose sight of the fact that God's paying attention to me, remember, I still have this need for attention. I have this gaping hole inside of me that says I need attention. And when I forget that God's paying attention to me, I still have that need, and so where am I going to look for that attention? I'm going to look for that attention from other people. And I'm going to do things, maybe even good things, Jesus says, but I'm going to do them so that I can be noticed by other people, so that other people can pay attention to me. So, a few questions. I think you can come up with some more here. Why do I? This is what's hard about this weekend. It's not so much of the do this, don't do that this weekend, okay? So sometimes lessons are easy. I say, don't sin, right? This thing is a sin. Don't do it. Stop doing it, right? Or do this other thing. Go home and do it. This weekend we're talking about not so much what you do, what you don't do. We're talking a lot about why you're doing what you're doing and kind of going deeper. Why do I do the things that I do? Why do I put on what I wear? Why do I do that? Other than I got to cover myself and, you know, you're always cold so you layer up or something. But you know what I mean here. Why do I put on the things that I put on? Is there anything in me that's saying, oh, I'm going to wear this and someone's going to notice? Someone's going to see me? Okay? I'm going to wear this and not this because this, you know, shows a little more. Someone will see me in that, or someone will think I am really fill in the blank because I wear this. There's questions we have to ask ourselves. Why do I act the way I do? Okay. I think maybe you're already seeing this in yourself. I think as you get older, I guess I can speak someone who's kind of getting there, not quite there, but I'm on my way, right? You look back and realize that a lot of things you do, the way you act in public, you look back and say, I was just doing that because I wanted someone to notice me, right? So I need to try to be funny so that I can stand out. Or I need to try to be loud so that people will know I'm in the room and not ignore me. Okay? Why do I act the way I act? Here's a big one, and we're going to come back to this at each stage tonight. Why do I post on social media? What's the purpose of doing that? Social media is interesting. And BJ told me that here at Cedar Park, you guys have talked some about this and done some discussion on this, right? So I hope you're already thinking about some of these things. But you realize the whole deal with social media is a little bit at its root about attention, right? And that's kind of what it's all about. I mean, I think originally, and my wife and I were talking about this today, I think originally, and there is still in social media, there's this idea of connectivity. We're trying to connect to other people. But if we're honest, most people, they use social media and they post things. Why do we post things? Why do I spend time typing out the thoughts that are going into my head onto a screen? Well, because I want people to hear it. I want people to see what I have to say. I want them to see a picture of me and notice me. It's kind of what it's all about. And that's what I was going to restrain myself, right? It doesn't mean that it's wrong to post on social media. I'll try not to say that too much more because I think you know what I'm saying here. But it's about the why. What's the purpose? What am I looking for when I post things on social media? I think those are important questions to ask. And it may change the way we go about using it, but it's more about looking inside of us and seeing what our motivations are. Kind of take the next step here. So attention is kind of in some ways the most basic level of a human relational need. We desire attention. God has promised us all the attention we could ever imagine and more. But if we lose sight of that, we're going to start seeking attention from people, okay, or from the internet, right? But kind of above that, above attention, although overlapping, is this idea of approval, right? Isn't that what we want? It's not so much just that we want to be noticed, although that's important to us, but we want people to approve of us. We want people to like us. We want people to accept us. Okay, that's a basic human a human need. Okay, notice some of the things that we're told in the scriptures about what God said or has promised to say to us. I'll figure this out one of these days. Look at Matthew 25. Once you see this, you'll know what it is. It'll be familiar to you. Matthew 25. This is one of the most famous statements that Jesus includes in a parable of his. About the men that were given the talents by the master. You remember this? There's the five, the three, and the one. And they go out and they use it in different ways. And when the master comes back, they're supposed to give an account for how they used what the master gave to them. So in Matthew 5, verse 22. Well, it's said a couple times, but this is one of the occasions here. So Matthew 25, 22, and the one who had received the two talents came up and said, Master, you entrusted two talents to me. I have gained two more talents. Verse 23, his master said to him, Well done, good and faithful slave. You were faithful in a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Enter into the joy of your master. Again, can you imagine? Can you imagine Jesus saying to you, when everything's said and done, well done. Well done. Good and faithful servant. Good and faithful slave. Enter into the joy of your master. Talk about approval. Do we need any more approval than that? Than Jesus saying to us, well done. Good job. You are a good and a faithful servant of mine. Enter into the joys of your master. Notice in conjunction with that, something that Paul says in the book of Galatians here. Galatians 1 and verse 10. Again, if we have the hope in Christ, that at the end he will say, well done, good and faithful servant, is there anything more that we need? In fact, that's kind of what Paul says here in Galatians 1. Verse 10. He says, Galatians 1, verse 10, For am I now seeking the favor of men? He says in response to these people that have been twisting the gospel to make it more palatable, to make it more accessible. He says, why are you doing that? Am I now seeking the favor of men or of God? Am I striving to please men? If I were still trying to please men, I would not be a bondservant of Christ. I want to read that again. If I were still trying to please men, I would not be a bondservant of Christ. Paul draws a pretty firm line here in the sand and says it's either this or that. It can't be both, right? He says, if I was trying to please men, if my goal was to be approved by other people, for other people to accept me, for other people to like me and to be okay with me, if that was my goal, then I couldn't be a servant of Christ. He says, if I'm a servant of Christ, I can't have that as a goal of mine. That cannot be my goal, to please people and to be pleasing to men, to be approved of by men. It's either one or the other, which causes us to think pretty hard about ourselves and what my motivations are. Am I trying to please men? When I do certain things, am I trying to please men? Make other people happy? Make other people like me, approve of me? If that's what I'm seeking, then I can't, in that state, also be a servant of Christ. To be a servant of Christ is to work for and to long for His approval and His approval alone. Well done, good and faithful servant. That's what we're looking for. That's what we're hoping for. And the rest of it doesn't matter. So, you got to ask ourselves, am I seeking approval from my peers? This is that group mentality. Okay? Again, if you're in junior high, you're in high school, this still happens to some degree in the adult world. Everyone has a group, okay? And we really want to make we want to be a part of a group, okay? And I'm not even talking about being a part of the group, right? Like the popular crowd. No, that's a group. Maybe you have that desire, but we want to belong to somebody. We want to have somebody to sit with at the lunch table. Again, these are natural things God put in us. I think we want to be approved of. We want people to accept us. But I hope you see in looking at this where this can become dangerous. Because when that longing to be approved and be accepted by other people, our peers, right, or the people at school, if that's what we're shooting for, then that's putting us in an unhealthy place. Because here's the thing, and you know this as well as I do, whatever group it is, it doesn't matter what group it is, whatever group it is, you gotta be a certain way to be in it, right? Yeah, they dress a certain way, you talk a certain way, you got to be interested in certain things. And if you do that, then you can be a part of the group and you can belong, you can be accepted. I think you guys know what I'm getting at here. And because we long for approval, we have to be careful that we're not seeking that out as our ultimate goal. Another question here, what about our parents? Are we doing the things that we do to be pleasing to or to be approved of by our parents? Has that become the ultimate thing that we lift up above everything else, right? That I want to make them happy. I want to please them. I want them to approve. I want them to think I'm doing a good job. And maybe since this is a session for everybody, maybe there's things to think about as for parents here. I'm not a parent, so I'm about as ignorant as it comes in terms of talking to parents about being a parent. But I can imagine, right, that there's some things to think about here in terms of navigating this, in terms of instilling in kids a proper respect for authority and a proper and a healthy love for you and desire to have that relationship with you. But at the same time, cultivating in kids the right kind of perspective about whose approval is actually most important. And who they should really be trying to please as they get older. Again, not a parent. I would imagine that's a tricky thing to do or a hard thing to do, but an important thing to do. So that as kids, we don't grow up being controlled and being consumed with, I got to please my parents. I got to do what my parents want me to do. I got to do what they would approve of. Okay? Could be that those are all good things and that all the things that they approve of are good things. But again, you don't want to put that in the place of, well done, good and faithful servant. Enter into the joy of your master. And then we're coming back to it. What about the approval of people on social media, your followers, right? We talked about the act of posting for attention, okay? But what we really want, because I think I'm right in this, what we really want is people to love what we put on social media. Now, I will be honest, right? I don't really use social media, right? So my wife had to coach me up on some of this. I was going to talk about Facebook, and she's like, no, people don't use Facebook anymore, right? At least not the old people use Facebook. Young kids don't use Facebook, right? They use Instagram and Snapchat. And I'm like, okay, how do you spell that? Let me write that down. But whatever it is that you're doing on social media, isn't that what we want? We want people to like what we're posting. We want people to comment on it and say, oh, this is so great. You're so cute. You're so funny. You're so this. You're so that. Like, smiley face, winky face. This is what we want. We want to be approved of. We want to be accepted. And with all these things here, and we'll sort of kind of point back to these three examples here. One of the things in that book that I mentioned, Counterfeit Gods, Keller brings up, is that one easy way to assess all of this is to imagine that the thing has been taken away. If you're kind of struggling, like, is this an idol for me? Has this been made an idol? Well, here's an easy test. Take it away. Hypothetically, remove it, right? So in this case, what if you didn't have a group that accepted you? A group of friends that accepted you? What if your parents, and maybe some of you in this room are like this. I knew kids growing up trying to follow Christ was not in the approval of their parents. But if it is, imagine, what if it wasn't? What if you don't have the approval of your parents? What if you post and people don't care anything about what you have to say? What does that do to us? Does that shatter us? Are we crushed by that because we're not being approved of or accepted by other people? And if we have a hard time dealing with that, then maybe that's an indication of how important that thing has been to us. But the third, and maybe, again, kind of going higher and higher up the scale here of relationship needs that we have. We want to be noticed, of course, and God notices us. We want to be approved, and God gives us, promises us, if we're faithful, all the approval we would want. But ultimately, I think we want closeness. We want closeness. There's a word for this called intimacy. And that word has been, come to be misused in our vernacular, right? And we make intimacy something that only means sexual relationship. But that's not what intimacy is. Intimacy is closeness. And the sexual relationship is a good example of intimacy because that's as close as you can be. And not only physically, but sharing an emotional and even spiritual, in the right way, closeness. But this is what we want. We want closeness. We want to have meaningful relationships, okay? I think we're serious about it. We don't just want to be noticed. We don't just want people to say, oh yeah, you're one of us. We want to have those close, meaningful relationships. We long for that. Again, God made us for that. And in fact, notice some of these things here. Look in the book of John. Something that Jesus says in chapter 14. John chapter 14. Just a snippet here out of a larger context, but notice what Jesus says here. This is kind of representative of stuff that Jesus says in this section of Scripture. John 14, verse 23, he says that Jesus answered and said to him, if anyone loves me, he will keep my word, and my Father will love him, and we, that is Jesus saying the Father and him, we will come to him, the one that loves me and keeps my word, and make our abode with him. So what Jesus promises here is that for those that are his disciples, that love him and keep his word, he and the Father, and other places he talks about the Spirit in the same chapter, but Jesus says he and the Father are going to come live with you. Can you imagine? Keep asking that, right? Jesus, the Son of God, the Father who created everything, dwelling with you, in you. Talk about closeness. This is what we were made for. This is what God made us for. not, he didn't just make us to notice us. He made us to have that close, intimate relationship with us. To dwell, even, he says, in us. And this is represented with a example in Ephesians chapter 5. This is important for a couple of the points that we're about to make. Ephesians chapter 5, Paul's talking about the marriage relationship. Okay, but a husband and a wife. And he talks about, you may be familiar with this, right? He talks about the different roles for each one. The wives should love their husbands, that the wives should be subject to their husbands as to the Lord. And it says that husbands should love your wives as Christ loved the church. And he talks about this relationship between husbands and wives and the way the husbands, he's going on about love their wives as their own body and cherish them and nourish them and all this stuff. Verse 31, he quotes back from Genesis and says, for this reason, this was back in Genesis 2, for this reason a man shall leave his father and mother and shall be joined to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So this is what men and women are supposed to do. Leave their father and mother, be joined together, be one flesh. This is closeness, okay? One flesh. Leaving father and mother and husband and wife becoming one flesh. But notice verse 32, what Paul says this is really about. Is God really, in the end, forevermore, concerned with a husband and wife? He says in verse 32, this mystery about marriage is great, but I am speaking with reference to Christ and the church. So if you imagine the most intimate, the closest relationship that is possible in this age, right? Husband and wife, marriage relationship. Paul says there's something even far greater than that. The husband and wife thing is just a picture. It's a metaphor to understand the real, close, intimate relationship, which is between Christ and His people. This is what you were made for. To be close to God, like a husband and a wife, to have that close, intimate, oneness relationship. And that's where we find deep, true fulfillment. Where am I seeking fulfillment? Deep fulfillment. Am I seeking it in the online? Maybe you say I'm beating a dead horse. Maybe I am. But I think a lot of times we look to social media because we're looking for that relationship. This is an interesting article here. I'm not going to read all of it. I'll be happy to share it with you in more ways than one. We can share online. I can give you this paper. But notice this. This is from NPR. And the title is Feeling Lonely? Too Much Time on Social Media May Be Why. Notice what this says. This is not from a sermon. This is from researchers, and it's on the radio here. It says, for young adults, social media may not be so social after all. Among people in that age group, heavy use of platforms such as Facebook, Snapchat, and Instagram was associated with feelings of social isolation, a study finds. The results surprised this co-author here. It's social media, so aren't people getting connected? Well, maybe not so fast. Here's what this says later on. It says, it turns out that people who reported spending the most time on social media, more than 2 hours a day, had twice the odds of perceived social isolation than those who said they spent half an hour per day or less on those sites. And people who visited social media platforms most frequently, 58 visits per week or more, had more than three times the odds of perceived social isolation than those who visited fewer than nine times per week. The study appeared Monday in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine. And it goes on to say that just because those things, if you know about statistics, just because they're related doesn't mean that one causes the other. Okay? Doesn't necessarily mean that because you're using social media, you're going to feel isolated from other people. But it goes on to explain some of the possible reasons. It says, you might watch on social media all these interactions where it seems like everyone else is connecting, he says. And this could lead to feeling excluded. The images of other people, seemingly perfect vacations, homes, and lives, even though those are not likely to represent reality, can make you feel like you're missing out. You see what the point is? The point is that we look to things like Instagram, Snapchat, Twitter, Facebook, because we were looking for closeness. We want to be close to people. And so we try to grab for those things. But in the end, it leaves us feeling emptier than we were before we started a lot of the time. Or maybe we feel empty, and so that's why we go do it. We look for these relationships online. I cannot have been the only one that's in this, and it's been this situation. I was on Facebook, when I was on social media, I remember as vividly and graphically as if it were this morning, the times when I would scroll and scroll, looking at everybody's posts, everybody's pictures, everybody's comments, farther and farther and farther, and the feeling of emptiness in my chest just got bigger and bigger and bigger, and it's like I'm looking for something to connect with, looking for something that will give me some sort of satisfaction and fulfillment, and it never comes. And this is what can happen with online social media, that we're looking for closeness. This is a part of who we are. But we don't find it there, and in fact, it makes the hole even bigger. What about a romantic relationship for the young people here? Is this something that you're always looking for? That, you know, you always got to have somebody you like, right? Because someone's going to ask, so you always got somebody you like, someone you're interested in, someone you have a crush on, someone you're looking to date, or maybe you always have to be dating somebody. Why do we act this way? Because we're looking for closeness, and we think that if I can just have that one person, then I'll be fulfilled. I'll have that romantic relationship. Or even maybe lower than that, we can't have it in person, so we look to things like pornography, which is even more destructive because it's an imitation of an imitation in some ways, right? Marriage is the representation, the beautiful representation of a relationship we have with God. But in pornography, we're looking for the fulfillment, at least the partial fulfillment, of the marriage relationship that we were made for, seeking it in something that is totally worthless. And talk about feeling empty, feeling worthless, feeling totally deceived. We look to these things because we think it'll fill us up. It'll provide us with that closeness. But all we get is emptiness. I want to end with two statements. One is from a guy named Augustine. And he lived about 300 years or so, 400 years after Christ. He has this quote that became pretty famous, which is this. He says to God in his book, Confessions, "You, God, have made us for yourself, and our heart is restless until it rests in you." God made us to find fulfillment in him. And until we have that relationship with him, we're going to keep looking for rest and for fulfillment and satisfaction. And we're going to be looking in all the wrong places. We'll look to friends, and that won't fill it. We'll look to a boyfriend or a girlfriend, that won't fill it. We'll look to an online community, and that won't fill it. We'll look to family, and that won't fill it. Our hearts were made to be close to God. And until we're close to God, we're going to be restless. And our heart can only rest if it rests in him. Which is exactly what Jesus said in Matthew chapter 11 when he said, "Come to me, all you are weary and heavy laden, and I will give you rest." Are you burdened? You're not fulfilled with relationships with people? Looking for fulfillment in people and coming up empty? If you're burdened and heavy laden, come to Jesus and he will give you rest. And that becomes our invitation tonight. I appreciate your attention through the long lesson tonight. But there is rest in the Lord, and only in him. And so if you're looking for rest, he can provide you with it. So for everybody that's here, young or old, or somewhere in between, this is a chance to respond to that. God has promised that we're going to sing. He's promised all these amazing things. Do we believe in those promises? And do we accept those promises that he will give us everything that we were made to have, and we can't find it anywhere else? If you're convicted by that and need help from the congregation or need to respond and come to Jesus, you can come to the front now.